Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homefront on Missouri Grassroots Radio. I'm Cynthia Davis, your host. As a writer, speaker, and former legislator, we discuss limiting government, fiscal responsibility, and fair taxation. I'm a mother of seven and a wife of one for over three decades, so I bring you my personal experience. And now it's time for Homefront with Cynthia Davis. Warm night to be talking about home fires burning. We've got Dr. Kevin Biesner on the phone with us. And Doctor, I am so excited you could join us. How is it down there in Florida?
Well, it's been cold down here, all the way down into the upper 50s and mid 60s. It's just terrible.
Well,
how are you, Cynthia?
It's been great. We had the perfect kind of snow today. It looked beautiful, like you feel like you're living in a snow globe. And then
I love
as soon
that.
Yeah, it was great. As soon as it would touch the ground, though, it would melt. And that's even better yet because you get all the beauty of it. But I'm really grateful you could join us tonight. For the listeners who don't realize what a person of prominence we have here, I went to the Educational Policy Conference back in January, and there was Dr. Biesner, who was speaking on all kinds of marvelous topics that affect us. So I wanted to bring an opportunity for my listeners to hear some of your wisdom. Dr. Biesner is a spokesman for the Cornwell Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation and is also an author and speaker on economics, government, and environmental policy, like our favorite subjects right there. How exciting is that?
Well, yeah, and it's a lot of fun. I've always been an interdisciplinary scholar who tries to bring together insights from my great love, theology and biblical studies, with my other loves, which are economics and political philosophy and science, environmental science particularly. And the Lord has really blessed me in the position with the Cornwall Alliance as its founder and its national spokesman, in that I get to interact constantly with our network of about 60 different scholars, roughly a third of them theologians, a third of them scientists, and a third of them economists, all working together to promote simultaneously biblical earth stewardship, which is not the same thing as environmentalism, but is instead the fulfillment of the mandate that God gave us in Genesis 1:28 to multiply and fill the earth, to subdue it and have dominion over it. And second, economic development for the very poor. Think really not much in terms of anybody in America, but people in sub-Saharan Africa who live on the equivalent of about $1.25 a day instead of the way we live here. And then third, the proclamation and defense of the gospel of Christ. And all of this in a world that's permeated by an environmental movement whose worldview, theology, and ethics are overwhelmingly anti-Christian, whose science and economics are often very poorly done, whose policies regarding environmental protection therefore often don't actually do anything significantly beneficial to the natural world around us, but are very harmful to the poor. And
well, I think
been infiltrating churches and twisting biblical teaching so that it obscures the gospel of Christ.
Right, the 40% left who still go to church.
Yeah.
But I think I figured out why we have a problem. And it says in your biography that you're an author and speaker on economics and government. And I thought, you know, that's the whole thing right there, is the people in government don't know a whole lot about economics.
That can be a major part of it, because what they fail to recognize is the basic lesson that the journalist and economic journalist Henry Hazlitt pointed out in his wonderful book, Economics in One Lesson, which is that the art of economics is to see the consequences of an action, not just for the people near to it, but for the people far from it, and not just in the short term, but in the long term. And all too often, people confuse good intentions with good outcomes, and they think that it's enough to mean well. But we have to actually see that our good intentions are coupled with sound policy so that we're actually helping people instead of, in many instances, harming them, sometimes as unintentional consequences of the policies that we take. That happens all the time with environmental policy.
So what actually, I'll tell you where I came from. I spent nearly 17 years in government. And I didn't need to know anything about economics. All I needed to know is how to get elected. The extent of my economics education was how to get donors to contribute to my campaign coffers, and then how to spend the money to get the most votes. I mean, that's as simple as it goes. And anybody who does that can convert donors into cash funds for the campaign, can convert that into votes. That's the magic formula to get elected. Once you get there, you may not know anything about how we're going to actually govern in a way that makes sense. So then it turns the elected officials into people who are extremely malleable and more inclined to listen to the lobbyists, because the lobbyists, after all, they gave me all this money for my campaign. Therefore, when they come knocking on my door and say, you should pass this to help the Ameren UE, or you should, something else is going to affect the gas companies. I mean, people tend to, and I'm not, you know, speaking in person, I'm saying the vast majority of the people in office find it very tempting to listen to who the people are who put them in office. That's only human nature. And then we end up with really bad public policies.
Yeah, and Cynthia, what I think lies a lot of it at the root of that is simply that we have allowed our whole vision of government in America to be turned on its head. Our founding fathers gave us a federal constitution that put very, very strict, narrow limits on the powers of the federal government. In fact, they put into the Constitution what's known as the Enumerated Powers Clause. And that clause says that the Constitution gives to the federal government only those powers that are actually enumerated in it. The result is that it's not allowed to do anything else by the Constitution. Our problem is that we basically forgot that a good 70, 80 years ago, and now our federal government does all kinds of things that it was not designed to do. The consequence is that millions of people see the federal government as a cash cow to which they can go to get subsidies for whatever. Maybe it's subsidies for the banking industry. Maybe it's subsidies for the auto industry, the agriculture industry, the energy industry, particularly the renewable fuels or green energy part of industry. Maybe it's subsidies for the unemployed, subsidies for those who are ruining their lives with drugs, subsidies for those who decide that they are going to have sex out of marriage and have children without the benefit of a solid marriage to take care of them. We have turned our federal government into this cash cow, or to mix the metaphor, we are a bunch of pigs sucking from the sow. And as the late Hans Senholz, the president of the Foundation for Economic Education, used to put it, Americans have become a bunch of thieves standing around in a circle, each with our hand in the pocket of our neighbor. And until more of us become convicted, that is wrong. that is sinful, and I'm going to take my hand out of the pocket, even if it means that I suffer. Until we do that, that is, until there is repentance and revival in this country, we're going to continue to spiral downhill.
Well, unfortunately, a number of churches were among those who came to me when I was in the legislature asking for us to spend more public money on helping poor people, but they didn't understand, apparently, that Jesus meant for them to do it. You know,
yeah.
Can you imagine how the Good Samaritan would have been different, a different story if the Samaritan had walked around trying to see who he can find to pay the bills for the poor guy who got hurt.
Yeah, and of course the problem is that so many people think, well, if you don't think government should be taking care of this, then you don't think anybody should be taking care of it. And what that kind of thinking is rooted in, frankly, Cynthia, is an idolatry of the state. That is, people have begun to look at the state, at the government, as if it were God. They go to it immediately for the solution to all their problems. What we ought to think instead is, look, God ordained the state to do just certain very limited things, namely to enforce justice, which means ensuring that you and I don't punch each other in the nose, steal each other's property, defame each other's reputations, and so on, that we do not harm each other. If the government would do just that and do it well, we would all be so much better off. But we have turned our government into a sort of a god, and we've become idolaters of the state. As long as we continue that way, we're going to continue to see God opposing, because God is a jealous God. And he tells us clearly in Scripture that he will not share his glory with any other. This is why it's so important for us as Christians to learn to trust God, to live in accord with the promise of Jesus in Matthew 6:33, seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things that he had talked about in earlier verses, food, shelter, clothing, and the things that the godless worry about. He said all these things will be added to you if you will seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. We need to learn to live that way. And that's one of the lessons that we at the Cornwall Alliance try to get across, and particularly when it comes to our analysis of so much that goes under the name of environmentalism, because environmentalism is, if anything, among the most prone to an idolatry of the state. Environmentalism tends to think, first of all, the word itself comes from a French word meaning to turn around, and it literally means surroundings. And, you know, Cynthia, hard as I try, I can't think of anything that isn't part of our surroundings. You know, not the sun, not the moon, not Alpha Centauri, and not the hair on the back of your head. Environmentalism really literally means everythingism. And so when we take on this sort of an everythingism mentality, and then we think that the state has to be taking care of the environment, and it means everything, then that means really that we have absolutized, we have universalized the state, and we've made it into a god. We need to back off of that, and the Cornwall Alliance wants to help people understand that God gives the state its own specific, peculiar responsibilities, and he gives the individual responsibilities, he gives the family responsibilities, he gives the church responsibilities, he gives businesses responsibilities. And if we would stay within our proper bounds, not trampling on each other's bounds, we would all be much better off.
So what you're saying is that the big government proponents have been using the shield of environmentalism to try and grow government bigger?
Oh, absolutely. In the 1970s, at the very time when the word environmentalism was coined, the word environment existed before that, but the word environmentalism was not coined until the 1970s. At that same time, you had a growing movement among leaders of the West European socialist parties and in some instances the East European communist parties out of the socialist communist parties into the newly forming green parties. And they were doing that, I think, because in one sense they were quite prescient. They saw that free market capitalism in the West was clearly producing more wealth and distributing it in a fairer way than communism and socialism were in the Soviet Union, China, Eastern Europe, and other such countries. And they realized we're losing the contest here as far as the creation and distribution of wealth is concerned. If we want our vision of government to be embraced, it's going to have to be on a basis of a different rationale. And they saw the environmental movement as that rationale. So they got out of the socialist and communist parties into the green parties, and they saw that as the way to further their vision of the state as sort of the incarnation of God. It all really reaches back to Hegel, the philosopher in the early 19th century, who basically saw the state as the incarnation of the ideal of God. And this is a major part of the roots of the modern environmentalist movement. It's why environmentalism and socialism go so much hand in hand. I was at Copenhagen in 2009 for the COP15, that's Conference of the Parties 15, parties to the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change and the Kyoto Protocol. And there were some 40,000 protesters there marching in the street along with the thousands of delegates to the conference. And I spent a lot of time in the streets among those protesters and talking with them. The two largest groups of protesters were the International Socialist Youth Organization and the Communist Party. And the most common sign that any of the protesters, not just with those two organizations, but with others as well, carried was system change, not climate change. And when I stopped and talked with them to find out what they meant by this, first of all, I found that none of them knew anything about the science of climate. But what they knew was their sign meant this: get rid of capitalism and replace it with socialism as the global economic system instead of allowing climate change to happen.
Wow, that's pretty scary when you think about what their real agenda is. But how did you actually get involved in studying the environmental movement? Did it begin for you, I mean, in the foundation of how the Cornwall Alliance came about?
Yeah.
How did that happen?
Well, it stretches back really to my love for biblical studies and theology, which developed actually early in high school and continued throughout my high school and college years. And then in the first 4 years or so after that, I was challenged to begin learning more about what the Bible had to say about helping the poor. And as I learned that, I found that there were a lot of writers who, frankly, at the time, I didn't know much economics, but I knew biblical interpretation and I knew logic because I'd studied logic a lot in college. And as I read some of these writers, for instance, Ronald J. Sider in his book Rich Christians in an Age of Hunger, I thought to myself, you know, I don't know economics, but I know Bible and I know logic, and he's messed both of those up. The book was wrong. Mm-hmm. And so if he's done the same kind of thing with economics and people pay much attention, we could be in trouble. So mm-hmm. I bought a stack of books on economics, and I read and learned economics. And sure enough, there were a lot of things being told about how to help the poor by evangelical, well-meaning evangelical writers that just simply didn't make economic sense. So I studied the economics, and then eventually, because of that, I was asked to write a book on the Christian worldview of economics for the Crossway Publishers, for what they called their Turning Point Christian Worldview series. Dr. Marvin Alasky, who's now editor of World Magazine, had asked me to do that. And one of the chapters he wanted was on population resources and the environment. And as I prepared to do that book, I said, Marvin, I can do everything else, but I can't do that. It is just way too big to do in a chapter. And he said, oh, good, do another book just on that. So it led to that, and so my two books, Prosperity and Poverty, The Compassionate Use of Resources in a World of Scarcity, was published in 1988, and then Prospects for Growth, A Biblical View of Population, Resources, and the Future, was published in 1990. And those just kind of, they shook up the evangelical world of thinking in those things, and led to my being asked to teach first at Covenant College in Lookout Mountain, Georgia, for 8 years, from 92 to 2000, and then at Knox Theological Seminary here in Fort Lauderdale from 2000 to 2008. And in the process, I also started getting asked to speak various places and to take part in think tanks and policymakers' meetings and so on environmental policy and ethics. And that led to a group of us putting forth what we called the Cornwall Declaration on Environmental Stewardship that came out in 2000. And then finally, in 2005, to the planting, the founding of the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation, which became my full-time work about 2010. So it's just grown that way, and it's been exciting to me because it allows me to minister in a way that uses a variety of different gifts that the Lord has given me through the years.
Well, that's pretty exciting. One of the definitions I got from the Cornwall Alliance website says that many people mistakenly view humans as principally consumers and polluters rather than producers and stewards.
Yeah.
And another one is that the earth untouched by human hands is ideal. So talk to me about how do we perceive, what is the value of a human being? Are they good or bad?
Yeah, well, clearly, first of all, we need to be really careful how we address that, because when we ask, are human beings good or bad, we need to first off remember the doctrine of Scripture that all of us have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. So we're all sinners. But that's not all we are. We are created in the image of God, crowned with glory and honor, a little less than the angels, and given by God dominion over this earth. We get those doctrines from Genesis 1, 26 through 28, and from Psalm 8, and then lots of other places in Scripture as well. So we are the image of God, male and female, crowned with glory and honor, given dominion over the earth. We're also sinners, but we are also subject to redemption by Christ, and even those who are not redeemed by Christ, even those who have not been reconciled to God, have, by God's common grace, the ability to understand his world and actually to improve it. And this relates to what you quoted there from the notion common in environmentalism that nature is best untouched by human hands. Barry Commoner was one of the originators of environmental ethics and ecological thought, and he was well known for formulating what he called the four laws of ecology. And one of those laws was nature knows best. And he went on to say that, you know, when people change the natural world, what they do is almost invariably going to be destructive. It's going to be detrimental.
Is that Mother Nature knows best?
Too often they will think that way, yes. Now, some Christians will find that kind of thinking very attractive, because after all, doesn't Genesis 1:31 say that when God had made everything that he had made, including man, male and female, God saw all that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And after all, God is perfect, right? So wouldn't everything that he made be perfect? And how in the world can you improve on what's perfect? So doesn't it make sense that nature is best untouched by human hands, unchanged by us? No, it doesn't. because we have to understand the purpose for which God made the earth. Part of that purpose is for his own enjoyment of it, to see the beauty of his own creative work. But another part of that purpose is that he made the earth to be the arena for mankind, his image, to act out that image of God and to be his representatives and to take what he had made and actually make it increasingly better. Now, the scriptures themselves tell us this very clearly, because even before the fall into sin, even before God cursed the earth because of man's sin, we read in scripture two things. Genesis 1:28 says that when God had made Adam and Eve, he blessed them and he said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and everything that moves on the face of the earth," which entails that it needs to be subdued because God intended it to become something different from how he made it in the first place. And second, Genesis 2:15 says that when God had made Adam, he placed him in the Garden of Eden to cultivate and guard the Garden of Eden. That means that the Garden of Eden, even that best place on earth, wouldn't be as fruitful without cultivation as with it, and that it would be subject to degradation, and this is before sin, before Adam and Eve fell into sin, it would be subject to degradation without guarding. So the picture that we get from Genesis 1 and 2 is that God made us with the purpose that, expressing his image as producers and stewards, we would multiply, move out from the garden into the rest of the earth, subdue it, and have dominion over it, turning wilderness, which scripture generally associates with judgment and the curse of God, right? Converting wilderness into garden, but not only garden. In the Bible, we begin in a garden, the Garden of Eden, and we end in a garden city, the New Jerusalem described in Revelation, where you have both city and garden. You have wonderful fruitfulness. And this is why at the Cornwall Alliance we say that godly dominion, what God calls us to in Genesis 1:28, means men and women laboring together to enhance the fruitfulness, the beauty, and the safety of the earth to the glory of God and to the benefit of our neighbors, thus fulfilling simultaneously both of the two great commandments, to love God and to love our neighbors.
Well, I like the idea of subduing the earth because it's cold and I need somebody to keep me warm. My daughter showed me a cartoon this afternoon where it had some people out camping and said camping is great for if you want to see what it feels like to be homeless. I like having a furnace that comes on in the middle of the night. Do you know how much you'd have to pay somebody to round the clock, keep your place toasty warm in the winter and to try and get it cooled down in the summer? Just the manpower alone.
Your point there, Cynthia, is so on target. Think about this. Most Americans spend a few dollars a day heating or cooling our homes, right? And those few dollars a day amount to a small fraction of our earnings, right?
Right.
For the average sub-Saharan African woman, she spends close to 6 hours a day simply gathering enough wood and dried dung to use for fuel, to cook her food, her family's food, and to heat their hut. 6 hours a day is spent just doing that. Now, in the Western world, we have an environmental movement that tells us that emissions of carbon dioxide from burning fossil fuels, coal, oil, and natural gas, are at risk of plunging the earth into catastrophe from global warming, and therefore we have to restrict the use of coal, oil, and natural gas. But the smoke from wood and dried dung is estimated by the World Health Organization to kill some 2 to 4 million people every year, most of them women and small children who are the most exposed to it, and to cause hundreds of millions of upper respiratory illnesses that are not fatal, but that can be debilitating for weeks or months at a time.
And we
that
thought smoking was we thought
yeah,
smoking was bad.
Much worse than smoking. But this means that if those people are not able to move out from using wood and dry dung as their main heating and cooking fuels to using coal and natural gas instead, then we condemn them to more generations of extreme poverty and of the high rates of disease and premature death that come along with it. The environmental movement is inherently misanthropic, anti-human, because it sees us basically as consumers and polluters rather than as producers and stewards. And so the environmental movement pushes constantly to have policies that they think protect the natural world, but that in reality do harm to human beings, such as condemning 2 million a year to death from smoke from wood and dry dung, condemning about another million a year to death from malaria because the environmentalists have persuaded so many of the governments in sub-Saharan Africa not to use DDT to eliminate malaria-carrying mosquitoes, as we did here in the United States in the 40s and 50s and 60s. This kind of thing is just tragic, and it harms millions and millions of people, which is why we need to learn instead to promote biblical earth stewardship or godly dominion, not environmentalism.
Well, that, you know, another question that came from your website, it says, for generations, America's public schools have indoctrinated our children with the dogma of Darwinism. Life arose and developed by chance, no creator involved. Now they're poised to indoctrinate them with another dogma, catastrophic anthropogenic global warming, and with it a whole catalog of other exaggerated and sometimes completely fictitious environmental concerns, all of them used as rationales for strangling restrictions on personal liberty, property, and the free market, and for instituting socialist redistribution. I hate it when they redistribute our wealth. But, you know, you're accusing them here on your website of that's really what's going to happen next. And this is where our society is falling into trouble, because Darwinism has been taught in the public schools for generations now. And you're starting off with, if we made the earth or the earth made itself, then it's up to us to keep everything nice. Now, we believe we should keep things nice, but how do you overcome a cultural clash where people have begun with there is no God?
Yeah, and you've put your finger on really the root of a lot of the problems, Cynthia. We refer to this at the Cornwall Alliance as what we call the spiritual world war. An awful lot of the various different battles that we Christians find ourselves fighting in the culture, in the political arena, the social arena, and so on, are really rooted in this one particular focused attack that the enemy of our souls is making. And the attack is on two verses, Genesis 1:27 and Genesis 1:28. 1:27 tells us the essence of man, namely, image of God, male and female. 1:28 tells us the mission of man, that is, to fill and rule the earth. Now, Darwinism attacks directly the essence of man by telling us, hey, we're not created in the image of God, we're just simply, you know, the chance product of evolution from lower life forms that came about by chance from non-life, and it's all meaningless. That attacks the sanctity of human life. Now, along with that, you have the eugenics movement, the progressivist movement, the movement to undermine human sexuality and marriage. So the battles that we see over creation evolution, over the sanctity of human life, over abortion and euthanasia, over marriage, over human sexuality, heterosexuality versus homosexuality and bisexuality and so on, all of those battles focus on Genesis 1:27. And the battles over economics, over the environment, over population control, over family planning, over forced abortion, forced sterilization as part of population control programs, those battles focus on Genesis 1:28 and the mission of man. And if we can understand that all of these battles are parts of a larger spiritual world war, then we can begin, among our various different Christian organizations fighting the different battles, to coordinate better, to be more strategically minded, and therefore to be more effective in that spiritual warfare. We launched a new initiative a year ago called In His Image. And I would invite folks to go to inhisimage2012.org. That was the year we started it, so that's why we put that on there. But it's an ongoing campaign, ongoing initiative to educate people about this. And then also to come to cornwallalliance.org and sign up for our free weekly email newsletter, which I think you're getting, right? And to read the papers that we've got there and all of the articles and so on, and come to us on Facebook as well. We have a Facebook group, Cornwall Alliance, as well as an In His Image 2012 page. So those are on Facebook. We would just welcome people to come and gain all sorts of understanding of this, share it with their friends, and become better equipped to fight the battles in order to, as Paul puts it in 2 Corinthians 10, he tells us that the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but are spiritual, fitted to the tearing down of strongholds and to refuting every false thought that raises itself up against God and taking every thought captive to the obedience of Christ. That's what we want to help people to do.
Let me ask you this.
We invite them to cornwallalliance.org.
That sounds great. The name of our show is Homefront, and
yes,
that's because we focus on how different public policies affect families and other foundational levels of our society. Can you comment on how the green obsession has changed family economies and affected the home?
Oh, my goodness. Many, many ways. I mean, the very simple fact that because of a lot of green policies, our energy prices are skyrocketing, which, by the way, candidate Obama promised would happen if he were elected. He said that electricity prices would skyrocket. The very fact that families are suffering through that is one of the consequences of green policy. But there are all sorts of other ones as well, things that people don't necessarily think of. For example, it's the green movement that has pushed so hard to force automakers to increase what's called corporate average fuel economy, CAFE, okay? That means that cars have to get higher and higher gas mileage. Now, you might think, oh, well, what's wrong with that? We don't want to waste gasoline, do we, right? Well, no, we don't want to waste gasoline, but we never want to waste any resource. The only reason we use something is that we think we're going to get benefits out of it. And one reason why it might be a benefit to drive a vehicle that gets only, say, 20 miles per gallon instead of a vehicle that gets 40 miles per gallon, part of the reason might be that the 20-mile-per-gallon vehicle is heavier and more solid and stronger, so if you get into an accident, you're not so likely to die. But another part of the reason might be this, that 20-mile-per-gallon vehicle might carry more than 4 or 5 people. You said early on that you had 7 children, and I have 7 children as well. And for a while, we had my mother living with us and my father-in-law living with us. So we were a family of 11. we drove a Dodge 15-passenger van for, goodness, almost 15 years. And you know what? We could put all 11 of us in that and be comfortable and on the highway get about 18 miles per gallon. In order to have moved all 11 of us in a vehicle that would get about 35 miles per gallon, we'd have had to have three of those vehicles. And so the ultimate gas mileage would have been less. But the point that I'm making here is this. The Greens' demands for higher fuel mileage in cars have resulted in the manufacturers making smaller cars, making it more difficult for families to transport themselves, and actually increasing the pressure, the incentive, for husbands and wives to decide to have fewer children than they otherwise might, instead of welcoming children the way Psalm 127 would imply we should, when it tells us that children are a heritage, a gift from the Lord, not a curse from the Lord. Children are a gift from the Lord. The fruit of the womb is his reward, not his punishment. Like arrows in the hands of a mighty man, so are children in the days of one's youth. Happy is the man who has his quiver full of them. Now, you know, I don't know about you, but if I were going into battle with bows and arrows as my weapons, I wouldn't want a quiver with one or two arrows in it. I would want a lot of arrows to launch out at my enemies. Well, the Bible sees our children, when we raise them faithfully to walk with the Lord, to honor his word, to believe the gospel, to obey his laws, the Bible sees our children as arrows in the spiritual war against the enemy of our souls, for as I quoted earlier from 2 Corinthians 10, taking every thought captive to the obedience of Christ. The environmental movement sees them the opposite way entirely, as just a drag on the earth, calls them carbon footprints, cancer on the earth, population bomb, population explosion, people plague, people pollution. I mean, that's typical language for the Greens, not exactly very complimentary to our kids.
And it had to have been a lot more fun driving the big van. Did they ever sing Three Cheers for the Bus Driver?
No, we didn't. But we did an awful lot of singing in the van, too. We sang an awful lot of hymns together as we traveled many different places together.
Nice.
Can I share with you just a few quotes from some environmentalists as to what they think about people? Mm-hmm. Just listen to this. Prince Philip of England, who is, you know, the husband of Queen Elizabeth II, he's a patron of the World Wildlife Fund, and he is an environmentalist, said, "In the event that I were reincarnated, I would like to return." And by the way, he believes in reincarnation, okay? "I would like to return as a deadly virus in order to contribute something to solve overpopulation." Jacques Cousteau, the famous oceanographer who produced The Undersea World of Jacques Cousteau, marvelous films about the ocean and life in it and so on, a fascinating man. Nonetheless, he said, "World population must be stabilized, and to do that, we must eliminate 350,000 people per day." And Ted Turner, the founder of CNN, patron of the United Nations Foundation, and an environmentalist again, said, "A total population of 250 to 300 million people, a 95% decline from present levels, would be ideal." Alexander King, founder of the Club of Rome, another environmentalist, said, "My chief quarrel with DDT in hindsight is that it has greatly added to the population problem by saving millions of lives." And Sir David Attenborough, the documentary filmmaker behind Life on Earth and many more documentaries, and a senior manager at the BBC and an environmentalist, says, "Humans are a plague on the earth, and behind every threat to wildlife is the frightening explosion in human numbers." You know, this is why I say environmentalism is anti-humanism.
I believe it. Hey, we have a caller on the line, and I was wondering if you could take a question.
Sure.
Real quick. Do we have our... Do we have our caller there. Would you like to ask a question of Dr. Biesner?
Yes, Cynthia. This is Brent Stafford.
Hey, Brent. What a thrill to hear from you. What is your question?
Well, actually, I was going to comment on a couple of things you discussed, and he actually just touched on one of them, and that with the Club of Rome, and a lot of people have never heard of that, but it's a group that's been around since the late '60s, but
yes.
They actually have published a couple of books. The first one was called Limits to Growth, and that's actually the best-selling environmental book in world history. But they also, in 1991, put out a report called The First Global Revolution.
Yes.
And that is actually the first time that it's documented the phrase global warming. You're talking about how it affects government, and this is all part of the global governance. And I wanted to read you just real quickly from that report where they coined this term. And it says, in searching for a common enemy against whom we can unite. And again, this is when the Cold War was pretty much over
right.
when this came out. It says, in searching for a common enemy against whom we can unite, we came up with the idea that pollution, the threat of global warming, water shortages, famine, and the like would fit the bill. In their totality and their interactions, these phenomena do constitute a common threat which must be confronted by everyone together. But in designating these dangers as an enemy, we fall into the trap of mistaking symptoms for causes. All of these dangers are caused by human intervention in natural processes, and it is only through change attitudes and behavior that they can be overcome. The real enemy then is humanity itself. This chapter was called The Common Enemy of Humanity is Man. And that goes to the eugenics thing that you guys touched on earlier, the population decrease you just were talking about. And this Club of Rome, the members of the Club of Rome are the same people that are in the Bilderberg Group. And they're part of the whole New World Order concept that's being pushed down our throats, and the Agenda 21 and all of that. So obviously you know a little bit about the Club of Rome. If you might want to speak to that a little bit.
Well, the quote that you've just given is a classic, and it really does demonstrate marvelously both the misanthropy, the hatred of humankind, and by the way, this tends to be a highly elitist sort of thing. They will talk that way about the billions of human beings who are not themselves a part of their elite club, but they won't talk that way about themselves. So there's an awful lot of elitism that goes on here. It's rooted actually in Thomas Robert Malthus's essay on the principle of population that was published in 1798, more than 200 years ago, which provided much of the intellectual ammunition on which Charles Darwin built for the writing of his Origin of Species, and that produced the justification biologically for the idea. It's a false justification, but this was the way it was used, the idea that there are higher and lower human races in the struggle for survival, which generated the thinking of Francis Galton, who in 1883 published a book that became the foundation, and I've forgotten at the moment the title of it, but the foundation of eugenic thinking, the idea that we could promote the survival and the success, the triumph of the favored races, the fit races over the unfit races in the struggle for survival through careful breeding, making sure that the unfit races didn't breed so much and that the fit races did. The fit ones, by the way, turned out to be the white Anglo-Saxon Northern Europeans, and the unfit ones turned out to be the black Africans and the yellow Orientals and the red Native Americans and the brown Hispanics and so on. It's just grotesque racism that is rooted in this stuff. And the whole population control movement of the 20th century is built on that foundation. The Club of Rome, in Limits to Growth, and then that later book, in both of those, it was building its thinking on the whole Darwinist anti-population growth eugenics movement. And so, on the one hand, yeah, you've got the misanthropy, the hatred of humanity in general, wedded to this eugenics kind of thinking. But then, at the same time, in that same quote, and I'm so glad that you quoted it because it really is a classic, you've got them saying, "Look, now that the communist bloc has fallen, we need a new common enemy to use as the excuse, the rationale to promote global government. We can no longer, use that enemy as that excuse, so we'll use this one, and it's going to be environmental problems, it's going to be pollution, it's going to be global warming, it's going to be overpopulation, it's going to be species extinction, and so on." The truth is, the real truth is, historically, that freer countries and wealthier countries also have the cleanest, healthiest environments. The dirtiest, most unhealthy environments have been in the socialist and communist countries of the world and in the poorest countries of the world. In the socialist and communist countries, simply because, hey, you know what? What everybody owns, nobody owns. That's why there's graffiti on public bathroom walls and not on your bathroom walls at home, right? I mean, that's simple. The other
well,
part,
and I think
the
this
poor
comes around to
have so much pollution because, look, if you're worried about putting food on the table, clothes on the back, and a roof over the head, you don't really care about smog, you don't care much about chemical runoff into streams, you don't care about acid rain or anything else. All you care about is surviving through the next few days, you and your children. And so poverty, not the poor themselves, but poverty is the environment's number one enemy. And economic development, which never comes from socialism, but does come from the free market, from free individuals owning property, being able to use it profitably and trading it with each other. Economic development is what enables us to afford to have a clean, healthful, and beautiful environment.
Okay, well, can we, we've got, Brent, thank you for calling us tonight.
Okay, yeah, I just want to real quickly, I think this comes around to the engineered global economic collapse that's also a component of what they're doing, because I've even heard quotes in interviews where basically their goal is a new feudalism with the masters and the serfs, and that's their end result that they'd like to see. And it's like you said, they see themselves as being the masters, and the reduction in the population, those that are left over, being their serfs. So thank you, and that's good hearing your show, Cynthia, and I'll talk to you another time.
Thanks, Brent. We enjoyed having you on. We have another caller, Dr. Biesner. If you can hold 1 minute, we've got somebody calling from, I believe, the Washington, D.C. area. Who's on the phone?
Hi, this is John Davis.
Hi, John. Ask your question of Dr. Biesner.
Hi, Doctor. You talked a lot about the harmful effects of government regulation on the economy overall when it comes to trying to pass these laws that seem well-intentioned in order to protect our environment but end up hurting a lot of people. My question is there any role at all for government regulation? And when I talk to friends who are in China you were just talking about how those economies, because they're so poor, they end up not doing much to control pollution. But I know when I talk to my friends who are in Beijing, it's a real concern when they look at the air quality.
You bet.
So as a Christian and somebody who is part of a commanded by God to take care of the earth, what's the role for the government in that versus just kind of private organization?
Yeah. There are roles for both. There are roles for government. There are roles for the church. There are roles for private, roles for businesses. All of those have proper roles. And I don't certainly mean to say that there's no role at all for government regulation. What I think we need is very much care to ensure that regulations are based on really solid cost-benefit analysis, and unfortunately very many times they are not. Furthermore, we need to recognize that what makes sense regulatory-wise can change over time as circumstances and technologies change. So that, for instance, I far prefer regulation that aims at outcomes rather than controlling specific technologies. Because if you say, all right, this is the outcome we're looking for, then all sorts of different people are free to come up with different ways of trying to achieve that outcome, and you wind up with a competition of ideas, which is likely to find the most efficient ways to do that. If instead you mandate you have to use this technology, well, you're picking winners and losers, and you're cutting off that creativity that comes from competition. But additionally, our cost-benefit analysis can change over time. For example, in the early stages of industrialization, when a society moves from subsistence agriculture to low-tech industry, pollution emissions will rise, and those pollution emissions will have harmful health effects. However, the benefits of the industrialization in terms of increased wealth, increased food intake, better nutrition, better water purification, sewage sanitation, things of that sort. The benefits of the industrialization to health outweigh the risks to health. And so you actually, it makes sense to put up with some added pollution emissions for a time. But as that society gets increasingly wealthy, then it can better afford the technologies to reduce the emissions, and you wind up with a cleaner place afterward than before the industrialization. So, for instance, in the United States, regarding air quality, for instance, I'm in favor of very strict controls over the emission of actual toxins and particulate matter from electric power generating plants and various other kinds of industry. I'm very much in favor of that in the United States because we're wealthy enough that we can afford to do that and still have plenty left over to make sure that we have adequate food, clothing, shelter, medical care, safe transportation, and so on. China is still at a stage in its economic development where if it were to crack down that hard on air pollution, for instance, from coal-fired power plants, although it would reduce the harm done by that air pollution, it would forego the benefits done by the affordable electricity, and the overall impact could very easily be more sickness and less life expectancy for the Chinese people. Now, to solve those problems is a very difficult thing. It requires very careful analysis, and the answers are going to change over time as technologies change and so on. But we can't just simply assume, aha, that's a pollutant, it shouldn't come out. That doesn't make sense because we don't live in a risk-free world. We never have, we never will live in a risk-free world. So, you know, is there a role for regulation? Yes, there is. It needs to be carefully based on cost-benefit analysis that has to be very, very thoroughly, objectively scientific, and not just based on good intentions.
And thank you so much for joining us tonight. We are getting time to wrap up. And do you want to give out your website one last time in case people want to contact you?
Yeah, Cynthia, thank you very much. We are at cornwallalliance.org. That's cornwallalliance.org. We also have a site called resistingthegreendragon.com where people can order our 13-part DVD lecture series, as well as our book, Resisting the Green Dragon, Dominion, Not Death.
Thank you so much. It has been a pleasure and a delight. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Cynthia.
This has been another edition of Homefront on Missouri Grassroots Radio. I'm Cynthia Davis and hope you enjoyed our program. Please join us next week when we offer another infusion of truth, honesty, and solutions that will grow people bigger and shrink government smaller. Thank you for joining us. See you next week.